waiting for trustee DeMeo, who's stuck in traffic, and we will need him for a quorum. So we will just move along with anything that doesn't require a vote right now, if that's acceptable for everybody. So we'll start with the invocation and pledge of allegiance.
Before invocation, I'd like you to please join me in a moment of silence for the victims and families impacted by violence in a recent event. Heavenly Father, we pray for guidance in the matters at hand and ask that you would clearly show us how to conduct our work with a spirit of joy and enthusiasm. Give us the desire to find ways to excel in our work. Help us to work together and encourage each other to excellence. We ask this in your name. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Some people here tonight would like to make public comments. What I will do is call your name. I believe you've signed up. You will come up to the podium, introduce yourself, and have 3 minutes. Mr. Prouty will let you know when approaching your 3 minutes. So we will start with Bill Coleman.
My name is Bill Culver, 4700 Sweet Meadow Circle, Sarasota, Florida, 34238. Madam Chairwoman and members of the board, my name is Bill Culver, and I'm chair of the Technology Department. My comments this evening, I'd like to draw your attention to the issue of faculty salary and its impact on succession planning. I'm aware of several instances over the past few years of offers for faculty positions being rejected due to the low salary offer. One of the biggest factors in these decisions has been the high cost of housing in the Sarasota-Manatee region. While the Consumer Price Index has increased 21.5% since I started SCF in 2014, my home value increased 57%. The faculty salary schedule has increased 0%. I was able to accept my position in part because my wife's employed and I was able to draw the pension from my previous job early. Obviously, not everyone offered a faculty position has those options. The impact of the faculty salary schedule being frozen in time is that academic positions are limited to offering salaries that were deemed to be competitive more than a decade ago. Which of you would be able to attract the best talent to your organizations with the same wages that salaries you were offering in 2010? As a point of reference, I'd like to tell you about my daughter, Alana. Alana graduated a year ago from USF with a bachelor's degree in K-12 education. She moved back home after college because she can't afford to live in the area on her own. Alana, with just her bachelor's degree and no paid teaching experience, was hired making more than an SCF new hire faculty member with a master's degree. Believe it or not, she makes more than an SCF new hire faculty member with a doctorate degree. SCF collegiate school instructors make more too. What does this have to do with succession planning? Well, as evidenced by the new construction in Bradenton and Venice and plans for a new parish location, SCF isn't going anywhere, at least not anytime soon, as far as the state legislature is concerned. But faculty are and will continue to go elsewhere, to retirement and to other opportunities if their salaries do not allow them to live in the region. Currently in the STEM division, one of the larger academic divisions, there are 7 faculty members that drop the deferred retirement option plan, which means they will be gone in a couple of years, 5 at the most. Offers are rejected and positions remain vacant. In the technology department, 80% of the faculty will retire within the next 3 years, including me. Only one is in the drop program. If the salary schedule is not adjusted to be competitive, attracting quality faculty will be more and more challenging. SCF is the jewel of the community. The dedication of your SCF faculty to the students and the community should be abundantly clear after the last couple of years. It is critical that the board act with all urgency to bring the faculty salary schedule in line with the economic reality of the region and the economic reality of the last 10 plus years. Members of the board, I urge you, with the additional $3.7 million in recurring funding, adjust the faculty salary schedule to remain competitive, to be able to attract the talent necessary for the good of the students, for the sake of the region, and for the long-term sustainability of the college. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Philip Trout.
Phil Travis, 213 44th Street West, Brandon, Florida, 34209. Don't start it yet.
I'm not.
I'm ready. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for allowing me to make a public comment. My name is Dr. Phil Travis, and it is my honor to represent the faculty as Senate President. With 15 years teaching in higher education at colleges and universities, I can say that SDF has some of the best, most hardworking faculty members. As the Senate President, I also represent the voice of faculty. So last week I polled our faculty on their primary concerns that all members of the faculty are hearing about relating to base salary here at SDF. And here are those findings. 68 members of faculty participated in the survey, which is an overwhelming majority of our full-time faculty members. Of that 68, 62 regarded their base salary as unsatisfactory or very unsatisfactory. 62, that's 90%. And the base salary schedule really hasn't changed for about a decade, and we all know how much the cost of living has skyrocketed. Many of you on the Board of Trustees are involved in real estate. We know the cost of rents. We know what housing costs are. I mean, and of course, in the recent term, $4.50 a gallon gas, inflation at a 40-year high. These are just a few things. We know the cost of living increase in our area. I also asked those faculty who taught overloads. Of the 63 faculty that teach overload pay, these are the extra courses that faculty teach, like an adjunct pay, 55 of the 63 felt that pay was unsatisfactory. SDF pays $18.50 for faculty overloads. In comparison to our 27 sister colleges, it's pretty much near the bottom. On faculty morale, only 8 members polled in terms of rating the morale of the college. 8 members said that they had above average faculty morale, and an overwhelming majority ranked their morale below average. Here's a few snippets of comments. These are direct quotes, anonymous quotes from faculty members. Quote, "Those of us who have single-income households can't afford gas and groceries." Quote, "The base salary for full-time faculty is incredibly poor. It makes me look for jobs elsewhere." Quote, "We can't compete with other comparable colleges around us because we pay so low." Quote, "I'm always on the lookout for a new opportunity because I don't feel this is the same institution that I was hired at." This person says, "I never felt so devalued as an employee and as a professional." Earlier this morning, a faculty member contacted me to tell me that an adjunct who received 2 weeks of unemployment chose 2 weeks of unemployment over adjunct pay. Wouldn't we all agree that we have some of the best faculty around in the state of Florida who are on the front lines in leadership teaching excellence during the COVID pandemic? So I ask you to demonstrate this appreciation by supporting a budget that would allow a meaningful increase to the pay of faculty. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next we'll have Matt Thomas.
So, Matt Thomas, 5204 72nd Street East in Bradenton, 34203. Thank you all for listening to my public comment tonight. I'm Dr. Matt Thomas. I'm the program manager for biotechnology and president of the faculty union here at SCF. At past board meetings, you've heard the administration talk about their plans for student retention and recruitment, and how critical both issues are for the college. Tonight, I'm going to make comments about the retention of faculty. This last semester, 5 faculty members that I'm aware of have resigned. Many of them were not close to retirement. Reasons vary, as you might expect, but job satisfaction and some of the comments Bill just made kind of speak to this as well. And compensation are important ones. This is, to me, a start of a worrying trend. Without quality faculty creating the engaging, creative learning experiences that we all want to generate here, I think we can all predict what will happen to student retention and recruitment. Not the trend any of us want. The administration and this board need to use every tool they have to make this an engaging and rewarding place for freshmen to bring their talents to help enhance our community. These tools include offering positions that are eligible to earn a continuing contract, and of course, the compensation. During each budget kickoff meeting that Joe Jakeway holds each fall, there's a comment about competitive compensation, how this is a requirement for the budget planning. Well, the starting salary for an SCF professor with a master's degree is just under $39,000. At Florida Southwestern in Fort Myers, a similar position starts at $48,769, nearly $10,000 below. We are not competitive on compensation, and some new positions are being advertised as not being continuing contract eligible. We are not using all of our tools. Tonight, the members of this board and this community will hear about the administration's plan for the coming year's budget. This is also the first year in a long time the state has increased SCF's reoccurring funds. I would invite the members of this board to analyze the proposed budget and determine, will it help provide the tools to help retain and recruit new faculty? They are so important to help this college. And if it doesn't, please direct the administration to make some changes to this. Thank you.
Finally, we have Claire Geiger. Can I make a note quickly? Yeah, you did. Thank you. My name is Claire Geiger, and I reside at 7127 Fairway Bend Lane, Sarasota, Florida, 34243. So my name is Claire Geiger, and I'm stepping out of a 2.5-year term as a department chair. One of my duties as chair was to hire and retain instructors. I'd like to read to you a sample of emails that I received during my term from potential and current adjuncts. Personal information will be omitted, and only those parts of the email that relate to adjunct pay will be read so that I can adhere to my 3-minute time limit with you tonight. So this email is dated March 3rd, 2021 from a potential adjunct. Dear Claire, I have decided to withdraw my application to teach at your institution. The salary that you intend to pay me is even less than the amount I was paid in the late 1960s. Thank you for your time in evaluating my credentials. This gentleman was from New York, by the way. This email is dated February 22nd, 2022 from another potential adjunct who incidentally had to check with her financial advisor before she could get back to me to let me know if she could teach for us or not. She also lives directly across the street from the Venice campus in Welland Park and rides her bike through our campus in the evenings for exercise. She says, "Hi Claire, I so enjoyed chatting with you last week. I know I would love joining your team of faculty members, but I'm afraid at this point I must decline taking on face-to-face courses this fall. It's too much on top of the online teaching load that I currently have scheduled with my previous institution, and the low pay doesn't really help." So in my own words, basically what's happening is, why would she teach face-to-face classes here at SCF when she can teach online classes from home and earn 3 times the pay from another institution? And I know it's 3 times the pay because we had a phone conversation, she's not mentioned in the email. And lastly, this email is dated March 9th, 2022, from a current adjunct. He teaches at a local high school during the day and teaches in the evenings with us. And he's responding to the question, my question, what classes do you want to teach in the fall? He says, "Hi Claire, I'm currently unsure if I want to teach in the fall. As I'm sure you understand, the pay isn't making a lot of sense for the time that I'm putting into the classes, and I know it's not something that you can directly control, but it is nevertheless something that I am thinking about." He still has not yet come back to teach with us in the fall. So, in conclusion, the current adjunct pay rate has been a deterrent in retaining quality adjuncts and in replacing them when they leave, which is not a good combination. As a department chair, I struggled with the difficult decision of whether I should hire a questionable adjunct with red flags, but one who doesn't mind the pay and doesn't have anything else to do, just to get a warm body in the classroom versus not scheduling the class at all. Neither are good options, and both have negative effects on student success, enrollment, and retention. I hope that the emails that I've shared with you tonight serve as red flags that SCF has become stagnant in the area of adjunct pay, and it's a real conversation, and I ask that you provide adjuncts with competitive pay so that we can continue to offer the same quality of instruction and course offerings
that our community expects. Thank you.
Thank you all for your comments. And now we will move on to the President's report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have before you my report, and in the interest of time, I think I leave that to you to read. I think it, what I'd really like to do is move on, if it's okay with you, Madam Chair, to the mission moment. So for the last 20 years, I've been working with first the business officers and then the presidents on trying to come up with a model where we can distribute any new funding that comes into our system that will be equitable. It's been a very big challenge, as you might imagine. We had models in place that were overly complicated. We had models in place that were so confusing the legislature opted just never to use it because nobody understood how it worked. But yet we continue to persevere and work toward this end. And the presidents asked me to chair a committee starting last year about this time to work with a number of presidents and come up with a model for distributing money that might actually have a chance of being successful this year. So we started in August of last year meeting with a bunch of presidents, and about seven of us, to come up with a model. The best thing that came out of that discussion, I think, is that during the course of that discussion, we had the opportunity to meet with both the Senate staff, the House staff, and the gubernatorial staff, and talk to them about what we were working on. And fortunately, what we were working on made its way into statutory language in a requirement for a model to be developed and submitted back to those bodies by September of this year. The two key points of that are the equity-based, and by equity, we define that to mean that institutions are funded similarly to those institutions that are like them in size, and they take into consideration fixed operating costs and variable costs. Simply stated, small colleges are going to have a lot higher percent of fixed costs than our very large colleges are going to have, and so there needs to be some accommodation for that in any model that we would pursue. So we're very happy with that. And early on in this meeting with the presidents, we came up with the objectives that we're trying to accomplish with this new model. And because we love acronyms, we're going to use our AIOUs. And the first being that it had to be adaptable. We know that over time, it has to be a model that can take into considerations that may now be something we want to incentivize. So it needs to be able to be adaptable. Second, that it needs to take in those economies of scale and equity across our system. Inequities have existed for the 20 years that I've been here, and every model that has been in place hasn't seemed to change those inequities at all. The only thing that seems to change your position is if you have any kind of legislative power, and that legislative power can drive money to your institution. Bad news for us, when we had the Senate president, we had Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, which took a lot of money away from distributing that year, followed up with COVID. So everything that we were able to put in to help the State College of Florida was unfortunately vetoed because of those issues. The third thing is we want to incentivize the things that we want to see. What we want to see is student success. Recently, the governor approved funding for nursing based on our performance. And so we said this is exactly what we're trying to do with this model, is incentivize performance and make sure we're not incentivizing the wrong things. It's output-based. We did a little research and said that you can measure the size of an institution many different ways. You can look at it in terms of FTEs. You can look at it in terms of graduates. One of Ryan's examples, you can look at it in terms of how many periodicals are checked out of the library. But whatever measure you want to use to determine the size of an institution, we have to use something to help us get to that economies of scale. So early on, we came with the idea that outputs, which are our graduates, is actually a very good indication or surrogate for enrollment. Almost every institution is spot on with your outputs relative to your enrollment, with the exception of two. So we thought that's a pretty good surrogate. We like that. The next one is really important, and that means it's unable to be gamed. And what we mean by that is in previous models, there were things like previous cost would define what you were funded for in the future. well, if you were highly efficient and you can do things less expensively, you would be penalized in the future because of your costs. So what happens? People start accounting for their costs very differently, so they can drive up these different numbers. So we want to avoid anything that could be gamed. It has to be factual. And when we talked to the House and the Senate staff, one of the things that they were most concerned about was that it could be gamed, and that they didn't believe in the data that they were seeing that drove the outcomes of the model, which again was why we said it had to be unable to be gamed, and it had to be based on factual information like outputs. And then last, it has to be simple. And when we say simple, we don't mean, simple would be every college gets $1 million. But that's not what we need. We need it simple. When we say simple, we mean you have to understand how it works. You have to understand what you do as an institution, how that can impact your ability to get additional funding. It has to be very clear. And nothing we've had up to this point has been very clear. So that's a really important concept that we want to drive home with our model. So we had some important decision points as we were trying to come up with principles for this model to be developed. The first is always a contentious issue, and that is every college has what we call your base funding. Some colleges are maybe more well-funded than other colleges are funded in that base funding. So the discussion always comes up, well, why don't we just redistribute that base funding so everybody is more equitable? That assumes that the college that might be more well-funded relative to the others is indeed well-funded. But we don't believe that that's the case. We think that when you look at the cost for graduating a student from the Florida college system, more pennies on the dollar relative to the K-12 system or the universities. So nobody is well-funded. Some people are just more poorly funded than others. So to just equalize the pain didn't seem to make sense. So we said, we don't want to do that. We don't want to make that our direction. So we said, whatever model we do, we want to be able to keep that base funding and build from there. The next we wanted to look at is, would it be oriented around inputs or outputs? There's always that discussion, well, you know, I have a lot of FTE that never graduate, but we're meeting their what they're looking for. They may transfer early, or they may only want a class to improve their position in their job. But we found that that's fairly consistent across all institutions. So for all of us, if our inputs and our outputs are pretty relatively closely aligned, then everybody is experiencing those same issues. So again, whether we use the inputs or the outputs, it's a good measure of our size. So we said, for a lot of reasons, output makes sense. One, it's factual. You know exactly what it is. Anytime we have ever had a conversation about FTE, the question is always, well, what do you mean? Is it the FTE at this moment, this moment, this moment? Is it FTE after it's adjusted? You know, what are all the different possible definitions of FTE versus outputs we know? How many graduates did you create? How many completers did you have? That's a very, very clear message, not to mention the fact that, again, the governor is very proud of a nursing funding program this year that's focused on student success and outputs. And so we said we can do the same thing. And we can actually be a statewide system that has our distribution model 100% based on performance. It's what we've all heard that people want to see, and we can do it in a way that makes sense. The third was, how do we deal with gaps in the model, the funding gaps that we'll have and that you'll see in a moment? How do we deal with enrollment growth? How do we deal with a lot of these other different kind of issues? But we said the good news about the model that we have and that we're going to propose is it has lots of flexibility. You can take all of the funding that we might get in a year and put it all toward trying to create equity amongst the institutions. You could conversely take all the new money we get in a year and fund it proportionally based on the outputs the institutions generate. Or you could do any mixture of those both. So we can take care of these issues by how we choose to allocate funding every year between equity and output. At this point, is my moving to you? No, this is my last one. Okay. I think we already talked about how we want to define equity. It's that we're funded relative to other institutions that are like us. In order to achieve equity in the very first year, it's somewhere around $100 million, between $100 million and $114 million, depending on how you look at it. So it's probably unrealistic that we're going to get there in a year, but it's certainly an idea of what it would take and what the disparity is within our system currently. And again, as I said, we can either choose to put it all toward equity, we can put it all toward output, or we can have some combination of both, which provides for maximum flexibility in this model. Now, I want to turn it over to Ryan. When we were meeting with the presidents, as I said, starting last summer and working our way through the year, we got together, we came up with our goals, our objectives, came up with the idea of looking at outputs. Then we invited the Brian Hales of the world and his counterpart at Valencia to come in and say, okay, now how do we create a model out of this? And it was Dr. Hale who took it, ran with it, and came up with the model that we're working with now. So Dr. Hale, all yours.
So some of the assumptions that Dr. Postfield has already mentioned are that we wanted a model that had simplicity, and by that transparency, that everybody would understand how they were being funded. What is the thing that we have to focus on to increase their funding? And using outputs, using graduates, was just the cleanest way to do that. Choose the one thing that everybody should be moving towards. We can include other factors and other variables. They do change it slightly. But when you begin to include those other variables, it just creates additional ways for people to be focusing on something that isn't creating a graduate. So, and that is the clear goal of the Florida College System institutions, is to create graduates and benefit our communities. So this model can be set up to distribute new funds to all institutions if we choose that. That was one of the concerns of some institutions, is that they would receive no new funding because they seem to be above the line. It can be set up to address all of that. It can also, or should not, I would rather, address legislative budget requests, legislative issues, or issues of local board control. Decisions that are made that affect that, like tuition rates and other things, are not included in this. It's just dealing with state allocations. The model is not disruptive if funding occurs outside the formula. If the legislature decides to provide additional funding to a particular institution for a particular reason, it doesn't negatively impact how the model functions. It actually enhances. So it would be providing new funds into the system, which would adjust how the funding of the system itself occurs, and we can look at that later. It would increase the expected funding for everyone. And this model addresses the distribution of new funds only. It does not touch base allocations. So institutions who receive funding that might be above what would be expected can be viewed as, it doesn't mean that the legislature made a mistake in the past, that was one of the things we wanted to be sensitive to. It just means that those institutions have been given funding that should allow them to generate additional graduates. So they've already kind of received it ahead of the curve. And it would hold those institutions harmless if they receive that type of additional funding. And it does not, once again, we had to keep restating this so people understood, not redistribute based on. So this is the kind of bones of where we began. The blue dots are the actual funding levels per graduate of institutions of similar size. And there's seven categories. We just took all 28 schools in the system, grouped them with institutions of similar size, and those blue dots represent the average funding for those institutions. The orange line is just if you kind of took a line and just drew it through the points the best you could, you could come up with a line and you can kind of measure what you would expect the school to be funded. This orange line is actually drawn mathematically to fit the points in the best way it possibly can. So taking that curve, we can create an equation that will allow us to predict the expected funding for any institution. So if you knew how many graduates you generated, you graduated 4,000 graduates, you'll be right here, somewhere around 15,000 per graduate is what it costs. Within that model. So using FTE basis, which is our inputs, right? That's the number of students we actually have. If you look at this curve and you look at the first curve, but kind of cut it off where the points are, where the actual schools are, the curve shape is effectively exactly the same. The scales are a little different because we're looking at how many students we have overall versus how many graduates. So it's more or less per student in this model. But it doesn't really effectively change how the dots align. Okay, and that was an important thing to consider. That, and that kind of goes along with the number of inputs we have does very closely align to the number of outputs we produce. So using that equation, the actual recurring funding per graduate can be compared to the funding expected for a particular institution based on the size of that institution and directly along the curve. It doesn't really matter which group they were a part of in the beginning or how they're averaged. They're not dependent on those other institutions. It's just how many graduates did you generate and what funding would you expect based on that. And once again, many other variables can be considered, but in the interest of simplicity and just trying to, we spoke a lot about rewarding behavior that funds directly how you get graduates. Some of the schools were concerned about square footage of their institutions. If you fund based on square footage, then institutions do things to keep buildings that are past their prime or build new buildings they don't need. It would fund the wrong, it just funds behavior in the wrong direction. So keeping it in something like this, where it's just graduates, you'll have exactly how many buildings you need to produce the largest number of graduates. So this graph shows that same curve, but with system actuals. So these are the actual schools spread out, no longer as an average. And for reference, this is SCF here, quite a far ways below the curve. For the number of graduates we produce, we're funded far lower. When I looked at it, we had something like 1,700 and change last year. We're funded like an institution that was producing about 1,100. So this allows us to kind of visualize that. If you had a school that happened to be above the curve, they would just be receiving additional funding that they should be able to put forward and produce additional graduates using that. Wouldn't penalize them for leaving. So using the formula derived, calculation can be made and get expected funding for graduate, and this allows for two different methods of funds distribution. The first is to address equity issues. When we used the model, the number we kept using just for the sake of argument was $60 million. If you had $60 million, you'd look at the gaps and look at how large they were for those institutions, and then it would distribute money accordingly. A smaller school would receive more per graduate than a larger school, but the larger school would receive the greatest amount of funding, total. So it worked very well with that curve. The other thing we can do is increase per student system-wide. Just looking at the curve and looking at the expected amount that you would get per student and then distributing according to that expectation based on the number of graduates you have. So if insufficient funds were currently being allocated per graduate produced for some institutions, we could distribute funds to those schools. And if the entire system needs additional funding, we could distribute it accordingly, but new distribution would happen according to that economy of scale and not in a linear fashion. One of the models that came up at the meeting, somebody suggested that if the largest school produced 15% of the graduates, they should get 15% of all new money. That would obviously be rewarding a school who didn't have as great a level of fixed costs as the smaller schools had, so it didn't really go with the legislative. So some other variables that have impacts that we considered. District cost differential. We looked at this. Dr. McKelvey at Valencia looked at it primarily. There's only a few districts in the system that are a great deal higher. There's only about two. And they just don't make up the entire service region for those colleges. It becomes a little confusing when we begin to use that. That's also a K-12 measure that aligns better to what they do. But if the system wanted to include it, if you said this school, it costs 5% more to operate in this district, they could just take those numbers of graduates, multiply it by 1.05 before you put it into the model. So you can be adjusted in that way. Additional campuses were also considered. The practicality of awarding schools for additional physical capacity in a day and age when a lot of things are moving more online might be rewarding behavior we're not looking to reward. Additionally, it was mentioned by one of the presidents that had he not been so historically underfunded, he may have had the operational costs or operational funds to build additional campuses. So you'd be penalizing somebody for their prior underfunding. High-cost programs, similar to district cost differential, can be emphasized by changing the percentage per graduate. If you have a graduate for nursing, for example, and you wanted to fund that at a higher level, 1.2, 1.4, you would just count those graduates at a greater rate. And similarly, CTE programs, the emphasis in Florida has been on workforce programs. You could incentivize those programs if they cost more, or you could frankly just incentivize them We want more graduates in this area, so we're going to give you 1.1 if you graduate a student in this area. So all of those things then directly drive the behavior of the schools to produce graduates in the way that the legislature could choose to have them produced. And it gives some local flexibility about how you get to that. If you incentivize FTE at the front end, you're always going to be putting more money to recruiting and getting students in the door, but not necessarily putting all of the funds to retaining them and graduating them in the same way. This would put all of the funding toward making sure you're doing anything you could, including bringing them in the door, to maximize the number of graduates. So it creates a very clean, simple model. Everybody can understand what do you have to do to function at the highest level for your institution, graduate the highest level of students. So it becomes very simple. Are there any questions?
Question and something that I just hope that you would comment on. So I just, if I'm understanding this correctly, the money would be, the schools would be funded in arrears because they'd have to report on the number of graduates, and that would determine their funding for the next year.
Yes.
Okay.
That's true. And effectively, even when they haven't been sticking to models, but they've been using past numbers to create regressions and curves to fund now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they base those things on projections that schools make. And it's however, whatever justification you can provide to your projection, whether that ends up happening or not. And so it becomes a completely gameable system in a kind of different way. So this at least is based on real facts. There are some things that might have to be considered. School had a disaster or something, but if you had fewer graduates because of some disaster, your base funding would be maintained. We did address this at the talk. So if your base funding was to say you had a base funding that would allow you to graduate 1,500 students, and suddenly you have some tragedy happens and you only have somewhere around the FTE and graduates that are around 1,000, you still have the funding to generate 15, so you have the funding to grow back to your previous level. It doesn't touch your base. It actually kind of has that built-in stability.
And maybe jumping ahead, but do you want to comment on where we stand with this and what your thoughts are about if, when, how long something like this could take to implement? What are the chances of it actually happening?
Yeah, I don't know that I can comment on the chances of it happening. There's a lot of decisions and discussions between that. I think you try to make the best sense of it you can and promote it the best you can so that schools can see how it works. Where we would stand if you ran it for not this year that just happened, but you know, we don't have that data yet. We're going to be running that this summer when we get it. But for the prior year, it would have said we were somewhere around $8.8 million behind. In base funding, and that's only that half of our funding, but you know that makes a big difference when you compound it year after year after year. Some other institutions, you know, are further behind, others are further ahead. So, but somewhere in that 8.8, depends which way you look at it, small variances. But when the recurring funding from prior year was 26 million, and it says you should have been getting 34, it doesn't really matter what lens you look at it anymore. You're so far behind. We're not going to get
that much. I would just add that some additional work has been asked of Ryan and Brandon, who's working on this model, as well as folks who had represented a different model, to kind of take it out 3 years and see what happens during that time. And what is really effective about this model is, and maybe you can describe the self-correcting aspect to it, where the other model that was presented really starts all over again every year, as opposed to something that you can use continuously forever, but has this self-correcting capability.
Yeah, and the self-correcting aspect was brought forth by one of the presidents who was actually a mathematician, and showed that if you moved all the orange dots up to the line, and then you redrew the line, it would then sit a little bit higher, because it would move out toward those outliers a little bit. It just shift upward. So we did it for year two. I didn't actually model it out for year three, but year two, this has 18 of the 28 schools would be behind the curve and need new money. If you run it out to year two, it becomes something like 23. I suspect year three would be probably 24, 25 schools would, you know, then be just under. But it's going to keep moving until either those larger orange dots, the ones above the line, either produce more graduates or until it eventually catches up to them.
And I think to your question about where might this go, there's been some discussion of maybe trying to figure out how do we bring components from both of these models together. So that work has yet to be done. The group meets again in mid-June, probably meet again in July. My guess is we'll be meeting again in August to meet the deadline in September. Some of the issues in this model that, you know, kind of fall in that political basket, you can look at it and you can say that we have some very, very efficient colleges and we have some very, very inefficient colleges. The colleges who may fall on that less efficient side don't necessarily want that picture made public. But some people are able to produce more with less, and that's what this is showing. And you know, I think that's one of the things we have to overcome with the idea, again, as I said, that nobody in this scale is overfunded.
Somebody is.
That school in particular was, if you go back to 20 years ago when I first started, was the college that, because that used to be done in the past, was everybody just got whatever you could lobby for. There was even no attempt to try and distribute it. That school was very successful, but what has happened over the years is their graduates have declined, but their funding has continued to grow. On the other side, that college has got to be very, very happy to hear that we're not making the argument that we need to redistribute this money. We're all just looking to sort of get to that level.
So that one's ours. So, yeah.
But much of that represents historical inequities that have been unable to be addressed effectively over time.
And to be honest, I haven't looked at, you know, the stocks that's out there always, but if you looked at that relative to universities or K-12, it might be funded. Our system produces and works with so many more students than they do relative to the funding. So that might be the right route, but we don't know yet.
And again, as I said, one of the things I think this does show is that relative to K-12 or to the universities, regardless of what dot you're looking at on there, the value for the output is just extraordinarily outstanding relative to other aspects of the education system. And the only thing I would ask of the board at this point is we have developed a model that we think really is responsive to the legislative intent, to equity and economies of scale. And to the extent that you have interactions with delegation members or politicians, that this model has been wonderfully responsive to what they've asked for and emphasizes what everybody wants, and that's student success.
I just have to say I'm in awe of the work that has been done here, and I think it's we should be very proud that Dr. Hale and Dr. Pogsfield really have led this and are behind it. We just have to keep our fingers crossed that this could actually happen in our lifetime, and if it does, you know, I think it's really going to address a lot of these inequities, and it's certainly going to be beneficial. And the thing that occurs to me is how incredibly efficient we have been with our resources, but certainly when you look at that chart, we have been relatively underfunded as compared to many of the other schools in the system. Thank you so much. All right, next up we have the non-financial consent agenda. Is there anything anyone would like to remove or discuss?
I would like to ask a question on the audit engagement letter. How often do we bid out our auditors?
So we most recently bid 3 years ago. This is our third year. Okay. We will be actually rebidding in the fall this year.
Accept a motion to approve?
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Non-financial consent agenda is approved. Now on to the financial consent agenda. Anything anyone would like to remove? I'll take a motion.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Financial consent agenda is approved. Now, Ms. Jakeway will present the first pass at our budget for the next fiscal year.
Actually, I think we're just...
Did I miss something?
Chris.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was just that informational...
Oh, that was the informational thing. Okay. All right. You get a pass. Mr. Wellman.
Everybody's here, because you talked about sewer maintenance, and then you all got up and disappointed me. A little bit more than the first day. So on page 72 of your board packet, you'll find a board memo and then a copy of our capital improvement program. And just a reminder, each year we have to submit to CIP, to the Department of Education that prioritizes our capital projects, and this is tied to our five-year education plan survey and tied to our five-year master plan. And just another reminder is that this CIP that we're going to look at actually becomes effective July 1 of 2023, not July 1 of this year. So for the CIP priorities for this year, it's section 3. If you look on page 80 and 81, as we do every year, the number one priority is always our deferred maintenance, your general maintenance, repair, and renovations, college-wide. Our number two priority is the Venice New Science Building. And the reason it's still on here is we're still waiting for that $1,090,000. Hopefully, the governor approves that this fiscal year. If not, we'll have it in the CIP to take it in the next year. And our third priority is the new health and human performance building on the Bradenton campus. A couple other items that are in the CIP. Section 2, page 78, is the status of all our current capital projects that we've got, tied to all the different funding sources. Section 3, page 80, you'll see a three-year list of our deferred maintenance, that maintenance, repair, and renovation. It totals roughly $20 million. This is the first year. They've asked for a three-year versus a five-year for that list. Section 5, page 93, you'll see our request for operating costs. For new buildings, which we haven't received in quite a while, so in there you're going to see a request for the Library and Learning Center, the new science building on Bradenton campus, and the studio for the performing arts. And last but not least, section 6, page 95, the back of the bill, you'll see a placeholder in there for parish campus.
You might have noticed that some of the pages got a little cut off, so we did put this at your place so you can see the whole picture.
Any questions?
And Chris, can you just tell us what the process is from here and the time frame?
It's either, well, we have to have it submitted and approved by the board by June 30th.
Okay.
So you can either approve it tonight, I can come back next month, and if you have any more questions, I can answer them. You can approve them at that time.
Any comments, questions from the board?
The all numbers we have. I'm prepared to put a fork in that. So recap. I'll make a motion to adopt.
Okay, if we're prepared. I hear a motion to adopt. I hear a second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is approved. Now, Ms. Jakeway.
Thank you.
segue into this partner program. And to the board, I hope you'll see a plan that we will bring back to you next month, fully fleshed out in the document. But this is the introduction to the budget for 22-23. A few facts as we start into the budget season for us to all be aware of. First of all, local area unemployment is at 2.4%, and as far as I'm concerned, that's zero. So we're having a tough time recruiting, as you heard earlier tonight. Even the state is 4.5%, which is pretty close to zero as well. Florida jobs by occupation. There is an anticipation that there will be growth in the number of jobs in these areas where we produce students. One example is registered nurses. In the next 10 years, 103,000 in the state. Interestingly enough, though, those same jobs, when you look at the pricing from 2020 to 2021, some of them have actually decreased, like registered nurses. They were, we believe, getting more salary during the COVID times than they are now. So that's probably what's going on. Just for your information, graduation rates by district. State of Florida is at 9.1, gone up just slightly from the previous year. Manatee's down slightly to 85, and Sarasota is at 91. During the same 10-year period, our funds have not fared quite as well. Our revenue has increased 4%. You'll see that tuition and fees has decreased 15%, and state appropriations have increased during that period. Our expenses, however, have increased 16%. Much of that is health care, retirement contributions, and current expenses to the software and other things that have gone up in price. The three documents that you will see next month include the fee schedule, the salary schedule, and the actual budget document. The fee schedule, we just reviewed 62% of our college course fees, and we are presenting you with the opportunity next month to reduce or eliminate some of those fees. We will, although some of them will go up in price, we will not be asking for increases or decreases. Some of these, for example, that have gone, what looks like a weird number, that's the cost of liability insurance that we want to maintain for that particular course, and so we will continue a small amount, but the rest of the costs have been reduced. There's the rest of the group that we're going to ask you for it again, these liability insurance stuff. So here's the big screen everybody wants to see. Our salary schedule for next year will include position level changes for some position eliminations. Title changes, we're proposing to move all hourly wage positions to $15 an hour, and then update the maximums on this position, which we'll see here in a minute. We are going to propose for current salary increases and increase adjunct faculty from $1,850 to $2,000 for a 3-credit hour course, and faculty salaries and overloads as we provided the CBA as well. Some positions in the salary schedule that you'll see next month that have red lines through them will be some of these that we've added and are replacing. Example is you'll see a coordinator for 26 West. That's a grant position, fully paid by a grant. A DUI evaluator as contract position for our Traffic Safety Institute. fund it from third party funding. And I'll ask you about how this position changes for the coming year. It includes more grants and a couple of replacement positions. On the hourly schedule, you'll see that we're proposing a number of things. And part of this is our response to trying to manage the ability to hire hourly waged employees. We have replacement positions with new titles, new duties. Some of these, of course, are ready for contract, but it will also appear stretched out items to be seen as well. Here's what we're proposing for the upgrades at $15 minimum. Our level 112, which up till now has started at $10.20, will begin at $15 and go up from there. So the high end of the scale for that one will go from 15 to 18 and on up to where we have one at level 116 started. We'll start at 1580 and go to 2520. In order to do the salary increases, we're proposing to create a 5% salary increase pool. It will generate about $1.4 million. And again, we'll be providing recurring increases up to 5%. Just so you know where we are on the salary adjustment scale, with the 5% for the last 10 years, we would get approximately 10%. And that's if you were this median group here. During the same time, the CPI is nearly doubled at 19.1. State appropriations have increased for us this year. I'd like to explain just a little bit. Total difference between 2021-22 and 22-23 right now is proposed at about $3.8 million. Then there are items for non-recurring funds in the budget, 1.6 for nursing, 400 for the coding academy, and about 200 for fleet cars. In addition, as long as I'm in the budget, you'll see 1.1 million that Chris was talking about in the remainder in a science building, and $8.2 million for deferred maintenance. That's in the budget this year as a line item, although it says in the budget it's for 2023-24, so it's a year out. That's unusual. I haven't seen that before. So the total increased dollars will go from 26.5 last year to almost 42 this year. But again, understanding that the difference in our operating funds is right here. Even without our lower division revenue, and we are assuming, because I am a conservative person, 5% decrease in enrollment will net us minus $500,000. The differences you see here are, this is CARES money that we received last year for low enrollment, for indirect cost and CARES money that we got here for lost revenue. As a reminder, the fund balances that we had on June 30, 2021, which I saw in February, include a reserve for encumbrances. That's paying the leftover bills from the previous year. Commitments that you approved last year for $3.5 million. There's $2.1 million in for nursing program expansion, and we got nursing money, so we probably not need it for that. Renovation repair funding for post depot, $2.4 million. Once again, if we get $8.2 million for 2023-24, we might not need that. We always carry a hurricane insurance deductible, and by law, we're required to have 5% of the reserve. In addition to that, we have about $7.5 million in capital fund balance. It can't be used for anything else. By law, it cannot be transferred into operating, but it is sitting there for us. So for non-recurring plan for this year, we're proposing what is left in our fund balance of the 2019 nursing dollars. We are going to have a one-time salary adjustment that is a technical issue. We pay 26.1 payrolls per year. They're actually 27 in a year, and that adjusts itself once every 10 years. This is that 10th year. Doesn't mean people are getting extra money. It just means as we pay out, there will be $800,000 cost for the current year. 2.9 in contingency non-recurring equipment. We're proposing $1 million for year one of the classroom technology refresh. Professional development training in lower level classes. We budgeted $400,000 from the fund balance. Advertising $150,000. This is a non-cash transaction that we have to budget for because we follow generally accepted accounting principles. So we always budget for this transaction, but it doesn't require cash. Nursing enhancement and the new budget, 1.6 is budgeted in the non-recurring plan. The coding academy at $400,000. So we expect to extend about $10 million or a little over $10 million, $130 in the next year. So if we look at it overall, our revenues with everything we've just seen will be about $51.5 million. Our expenditures, including those non-recurring dollars, will be about $58.5 million, a difference of $7 million from the fund balance. Now I want to share that in order to generate the $1.3 million from raises and some other activities that we're proposing, we've actually reduced operating budgets by just short of $2 million. Upper division, we're expecting about 1.4 for next year, both revenues and expenditures. Fund two is grants and contracts. The student activities group approved a budget of $1.6 million for the coming year. And other grants and contracts, we expect expenditures of about $8.8 million related to what's left of the CARES money, the driver improvement, work study dollars, they're all lumped together there. And the last thing you'll see here is the Bradenton Collegiate and the Venice Collegiate. Those are right now budgeted at the exact same amount this year because we don't have a budget for that from the county. As soon as we get a budget, we'll either bring it to you in June, or if we don't, we'll ask for a continuation budget and bring it back to you in September. Here's the total grants and contracts. The difference both in revenues and expenditures here is CARES. And there's the Bradenton School, as I mentioned, same as last year. The Venice School, same as last year. And the last thing that we have here is capital funds. We have an estimated balance of a little over $17 million. We expect to generate about $250,000 in what's called capital outlay and debt service. And that is license plate fees. We get a portion of the state mandate plate fee. $9 million for other projects, including the remainder of those CARES capital projects that will be extended before June 30th. And $3.5 million in PICO, noticing that the $8.2 million that we talked about for the fund amendments will not be budgeted because it's for 2023-24, unless they change the number. So budgeted expenditures, $18 million, and that leaves us with an estimated capital at the end of the year of 11.7.
Julie, I just had one question. When and it goes back to 26 West with all the in the budget side. A lot of those were under the grants. So can you remind me what's that grant and are we starting to track revenue to expense so we understand that it's when the grants expire, it's going to be a profitable.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it came from the Enterprise Florida, the DBO grant, $3.6 million. And yes, we are tracking the revenue and expense of actually profitability of those various units to ensure that we fully expend the grant dollars. So we're pooling those dollars now so that we can draw from them when the grant dollars are done because we want to fully rely on them for as long as we can. Mm-hmm. But we're doing separate P&Ls and each functional unit over there to start tracking the profitability.
Thank you.
Yep.
Julie, one question on the fee schedule. Help me understand the rationale behind eliminating or reducing the fees.
That we evaluated the cost of the course and the money that had been generated for it were for things that we no longer using.
Okay.
How much did that represent in a year?
$49,000 a year, about in a year, if those courses were being taught and that was being used. But for the most part, that's not the case. Many of those were eliminated courses.
Any other comments, questions? I guess we'll be seeing this again next month.
Next month. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. First of all, I wanted to thank all of you, trustees. You clearly put a lot of time and thought into Dr. Probstfeld's evaluation. Has everyone had a chance to look at the comments and the aggregated scores? Well, let me tell you about it. As we've seen in the past, Dr. Probstfeld has scored very well. The way that it's aggregated is, I'll tell you, the number of responses that were outstanding, highly skilled, satisfactory, needs improvement, or not enough information to rate. So on almost every measure, she received a minimum of 5 outstanding ratings. And on mission effectiveness and fiscal management, she received 6 and 7 outstanding ratings, respectively. So 83% of all ratings were outstanding. There were also a lot of thoughtful comments, which we really appreciate, because I think it's very helpful to you. Do we have any comments, or would anyone like to share or say anything about this?
I think it's very representative. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yes, very much agreed. I know certainly it's been a challenging couple of years. Of course, we got through COVID, and there were a lot of comments about Dr. Probstfeld and her team's ability to pivot on a dime, pretty much. And we got through it as an institution, I think, as successfully as anyone could. And a lot of that was just planning that happened before we ever knew that a pandemic was going to hit, but also just a general attitude of flexibility. And that, you know, we couldn't do the same things the way we had always done them, and we had to serve our students above all. So I know we're all very grateful to your team and you for being able to do that. And then, as we can see from our budget presentation and the model that was presented, we're always fighting the budget battle, trying to find more money for our institution, for the people who work here, but it's government. And we are under a lot of constraints, a lot of regulations. We can't operate like a private business, but I know that the team is always trying to find a way to make our budget work harder and make it work for the people here. So thank you. All right, is there any old business be brought forward? Any new business? Any board comments, Mike?
Well, from the foundation, just a few updates. Number one, the 24-hour giving challenge, that's where the Patterson Foundation matches up to $100 donation, and the foundation just wants to thank the SCF employees and the directors of the foundation and the trustees. We had a lot of giving, and the total raise was over $14,430. Our total earned fundraising revenue through March, and obviously we have 4 months left through March or April?
May the 19th,
or thereabouts. The budget was $2 million for the year. Cassandra and her team and the foundation has raised $2.3 million, so We still got 4 months to go. So they're doing a great job over at the foundation. And then lastly, there is a partnership between the Lakewood Ranch Business Alliance and the SCF Lakewood Ranch campus. It's an after-hours networking social Wednesday, August 3rd from 5 till 7. There's estimated to be 150 people in attendance. Everybody is invited. You can just go to the Lakewood Ranch Business Alliance website and sign up for that. That's it.
Thank you.
I apologize for being late. I'm sorry about that. I hit a little bit of traffic on 301 that I wasn't expecting. And Dr. Harrell, thank you for making us shine with state. Not just putting the work in, but the work that actually is going to change, hopefully change what happens for the school as well. So thank you.
I have a couple things I want to bring, but this budget is a complex issue to be seen tonight and then voted on at our next meeting. I'm going to ask that I can come and sit with Julie for a while on this. I don't know if any of my board members feel the same way. I don't know if you have a workshop on this thing or whatever, but I don't feel comfortable right now without at least talking about it. So I'd like to be doing that. I don't know if the rest of the board wanted to do a workshop on it. I don't know, but it's a lot to go over, just to be thrown at you at the, tonight and then next month. So I have to offer that up.
I don't think a workshop, given that it's my first budget vote.
I think we'd be happy to do a workshop. Is that something we can do virtually, Steve?
I can't.
I would suggest not in this case because it's the budget. The workshop is a public meeting, so it's an opportunity for the public to be there. Mm-hmm. So it would be my suggestion, if it's convenient for everybody, to do it the way we do this. We can have some attendance by teams, but it probably is best to meet face to face.
Well, I will leave it to you to see what everyone's schedules look like and see if we can find probably at least a couple of hours to spend with Julie. And certainly, you're right, Mark, it is incredibly complex and bears no resemblance whatsoever to a private business budget or even the average nonprofit organization. There are so many funds and they all have very specific uses, and it takes a lot of time to try to understand it at just the most basic level. So I think even those of us who've been on the board for a while can always use a refresher.
Well, I think we have some employees that bring up some pretty good points tonight. And we'd be remiss if we didn't try to address it as best we can, the monies we have available. And I simply can't feel comfortable talking about it. Presentation. I got to look at somehow dig into numbers that I have the ability to dig in on my own. So.
I just wanted to thank the public comment for being so courteous and professional with their comments. We obviously want public comment, we respect public comment, but apropos to kind of the society we're living in right now, it's not always the case. So I you're much better heard in a courteous, professional manner, so I really appreciate it.
Very much agreed. Thank you. Right. There are no...
I'd just like to thank the board for your comments, for your confidence, your trust. It means a lot to me and my senior administration team to know that we have your support as we're leading this institution, so thank you.
Any further comments? All right, this meeting is adjourned.